All right, and we are rolling in 3, 2, 1. Since his first book, The Meadowlands, was published in 1998, Bob Sullivan has steadily built his reputation as a quirky master of narrative fiction. His New York Times bestseller, Rats, explored the lives and history of New York City's most hated residents, and in Cross Country, he gave his readers a wide-ranging and rich celebration of cross-country travel. His new book is My American Revolution, not a typical history book, instead a refreshingly personal investigation into the important and too often overlooked roles played by New York and New Jersey in the American Revolution. Again, the name of the book is My American Revolution, Crossing the Delaware and I-78. Robert Sullivan joins us on the program this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure.
Oh, no, thank you.
The book is very entertaining, very enjoyable. What brought you to think about New York, New Jersey's role in the American Revolution?
Well, I grew up in New York and New Jersey, in Queens, Long Island, New Jersey. I've lived in many boroughs, not all. And then the other thing was I moved to Oregon, where my wife's from, and one time we were following the Lewis and Clark Trail, and I ran into the guy who was playing, I think it was Lewis, and he was a French Indian War reenactor. And French Indian War reenactors, instead of kind of wearing the clothes of reenactment, often go to find the places. And suddenly occurred to me that there had been all these places where I grew up, and they were kind of considered the footnotes of the revolution, of our history. And so I just thought I'd sort of take my feet and kind of follow the notes around here.
Why do you think that these middle colonies are so often overlooked when it comes to the revolution?
Well, I think that Boston is, you know, really where it started. There was a lot of, you know, very radical stuff going on in Boston, as there was in New York. There was a group called the Liberty Boys in New York who were stirring up a lot of trouble for people in charge, for the crown. And likewise, in Philadelphia, you know, there was a plebiscite, probably the closest they came to a referendum in the colonies was in Philadelphia, and they made this very, again, radical document called the Declaration of Independence. But, you know, after the British left Boston on St. Patrick's Day in 1776, they went off and geared up, literally, in Halifax, and they came back to the U.S. to fight the army that was not just going to kind of collect to fight them, but the Continental Army was now training and establishing itself and building battlements all around the New York City landscape. And this was it. This was, you know, stage one, act one, scene one of the revolution right here in New York. But we lost. Everything about what happened, especially in the beginning of the war, was about losing in New York. And, you know, to this day, New Yorkers in particular don't like to lose, but I don't know too many people who are, you know, really good at losing. Then again, if you are good at losing, it sometimes helps you, and that's really the big point here is that Washington learned how not so much to win the war with a little tiny army against a big one, but how not to lose it. And a really excellent thing is that he did that with the geography of the area.
How did the book evolve for you? Where did it start, and how did it evolve?
Well, I'm crazy, so. So I walk around in circles a lot in my office, and I read stuff, and I read about a hill and a battle, for instance, in this book, and I say, oh my God, I think I remember a plaque that I saw in New Jersey once when I was a newspaper reporter, or wait a minute, didn't my father talk about signals off of some hill in Morristown, New Jersey? Were there really signals back to New York City, or to where? Where do they go? And then I started just kind of taking trips. Now, I think I got really excited about the Battle of Brooklyn, the big initial loss of the Continental Army in 1776 in the fall around this time, the end of summer. I think I got really interested in that around 2000. I remember my son was little, and we'd go hear lectures and walk around and look for the battlefield in places in New York where you'd think there'd be no fields, except they coincidentally are, those fields are now Greenwood Cemetery and Prospect Park. So strangely, the city almost accidentally preserves these old places better than, say, a Confederate battlefield, a battlefield the Union and the Confederates fought on in Virginia that might be a mall now, a strip mall now. Now, there obviously are some fields, but here the King's Highway is still the King's Highway in Queens. So, pardon me, in Brooklyn. So basically it was me reading stuff and saying, I wonder if you could see that. And then at last saying, I wonder if I can go back and experience these places in the landscape in the same time in the calendar that the revolutionaries did.
So an almanac was very much your guide.
It's all about the almanac. And, you know, it's not really clear where that word almanac comes from. I love the fact that everybody in the continental United States, in colonial U.S., in a colonial America, everybody would have had an almanac. And people in New York and along the coast would have been so interested in the tides and the moons. And in that calendar, you know, they just had these facts. But, of course, in 1776 or 7, George Washington's birthday shows up. He is made the father of the country while he is in the New York area. It's so quick that he becomes the father of our country when we switch out one George, King George, for this new George. But, yeah, almanac. And there again, where the word came from, maybe it's an Arabic word. Maybe it means fate or time. But, yeah, to look at the day in the calendar, the day in the season, and to look back at all of the history through a day, whether it be, you know, in 1789 in April, the inauguration of Washington, when he was rowed across Newark Bay and or through the Arthur Kill and across New York Harbor to Wall Street, or whether, you know, today you're taking a ferry, or whether in 1939 you were a painter who a realist painter who worked for the World Telegram, who was playing Washington and being brought in to New York in a reenactment. Or there was another reenactment in 1932 that Jimmy Walker attended, and that was run by Washington was then a socialite who put on big balls. So to look through the kind of the different reenactments throughout time, to look at the landscape, to look at the landscape of history and history in the landscape.
You do seem to very much celebrate these reenactors and these amateur historians and these artists who try to keep this history alive.
Well, I celebrate is the word, because, I mean, I guess, you know, this to me is the most inspiring and almost the most interesting thing. You know, you end up asking the question, what is history anyway? I mean, how can you get back to what happened? It's so difficult. So, you know, I suppose in some ways it's a cop-out, but I'm looking at how people deal with the fact that they don't know, or how they try to know. Or, you know, I remember on the Lewis and Clark reenactment that I had run into, Lewis and Clark had a fight, the two reenactors. They broke up. I will tell you that they did get together again by the end of the reenactment.
Excellent.
But, you know, one was very interested in the kind of archaeology of costumes and the clothing. And the other guy was, you know, wanted to rough it like a French Indian War reenactor. So that battle in itself, you're right. What's the difference? What does that mean? But ultimately, it's all the people who cared about history that, you know, throughout New York's forgotten revolutionary past. You know, like all these people who tried to collect it and collate it and maybe gotten things wrong, or whatever wrong means. It can mean different things. Or maybe they've gotten it right and they've been forgotten. Maybe they battled to get a battlefield remembered, and they lost, which is kind of what happened here with the Maryland Regiment, who kind of held back the British Army while Washington escaped off to Manhattan. But, you know, that to me is really the most that I can grapple with. How am I thinking about the past, and what does it affect? How does it affect me? And that's why this is a particularly great area to look at that, because this is the landscape of loss and the forgotten landscape.
There is a picture of you on the front cover of the book sitting in a boat. I assume that's on the Delaware River.
That is actually off the coast of Rikers Island.
Okay.
It is actually a different watershed. It's actually in New York City. I do a lot of stuff on the harbor in New York, and the harbor is really interesting because, you know, I can take the Staten Island Ferry and without paying any money at all, have a part of a reenactment of a Washington boat trip. Or on September 11th, there was a peace council that was attempted after the war started, and Benjamin Franklin, John Adams, and a guy named Talmadge rowed over to Staten Island to meet with General Howe. I can pretty much do that right now. The harbor is what it was, and you know, the harbor is sort of yesterday's Catskills rain and tomorrow's Atlantic. So it just always is the same by virtue of its definition. But no, I tried to get, you know, I tried to convince them to put somebody else on the cover. Somebody, you know, like maybe Justin Bieber would be. I thought I was sort of the last choice. But there I am, and we just got a boat out of the Bronx, and we went out underneath the Whitestone Bridge. And so that's kind of the, you know, East River, beginning of Long Island Sound, where the British fleet actually came up and landed once at the wrong tide moment. They had to pull out again, go try another spot. And then the second time they landed in the Bronx and had a battle that is today marked by the same stone wall on a hole on a golf course that the that is in Pelham Bay Park.
Mm. I asked the question because you do explore the crossing of the Delaware in the book.
Yeah, the crossing of Delaware is at the very, if you take the panorama of New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, if you look at kind of the 11 o'clock TV news weather map that you see if you're a New Yorker or even a kind of South Jerseyan or a Connecticuter, I don't know what that word is, if you do that, that map is where I argue most of the war was fought. I mean, there were obviously many battles, you know, way south. There were battles off the coast of Georgia. There were battles in Canada. But you know, the strategy of the war always stayed around New York. And anyway, that map, at the very end of that map, that sort of bottom left corner is the crossing of the Delaware, which is interesting because it's a reenactment that maybe I can kind of see that Washington himself might have, he took a minute on his trip back when he became president, trip from Mount Vernon to New York City. He took a minute to be alone to look at the site where he crossed. Could that have been the first mental reenactment? I don't know. But anyway, there seemed to have been reenactments in the 1860s there, and certainly in the 1950s when one guy, a kind of impresario, said, let's try it in a boat, and began to do it. Since then, there's been a reenactment there every Christmas. And I took that reenactment and kind of did the history of the reenactment and kind of broke that down to see what's the history of a reenactment.
You know, I grew up around there, and I didn't know this till reading the book, but on a clear day, you can see New York City from that site.
On a clear day, I don't know, from Bowman Tower, on a clear day, you can see down there from the Empire State Building. You can see towards Remarkable Hill.
I didn't know that.
Yeah,
and that's fascinating.
There's an interesting kind of corollary fact, and that is that it is thought that the first ever television show broadcast from NBC out of a transmission tower in the Empire State Building was by an artist named John, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing this right, Nagy, G-N-A-G-Y, Nagy Nagy, who had a How to Be an Artist program. And he drew a tree that was at the site of the crossing of the Delaware, at Washington's crossing. So the first television program broadcast from the Empire State Building, and Empire State is maybe a term that Washington himself coined, but the first program broadcast was about the landscape of the Washington-Delaware crossing.
Talk a little bit about the footnotes and the notes at the end of the book, which take up quite a bit of the book.
Well, I would have to point first, of course, back to my insanity, my craziness. I kind of can't let points go, and I'm just fascinated how things connect. And, you know, for instance, George Washington's born in February. My wife's birthday's February. My birthday's February. We were married in February. Every date in the book, February seemed to come up constantly. What's that all about? I should just let that go, but I can't. Anyway, the big point, though, about the footnotes is that because the story of the revolution in the New York area is sort of a footnote, it's not considered to be the main story, I made that idea that this is the footnote of history, that these are the footnotes, I put those in the kind of top part of the book, the regular part you read, and I took the big history, quote-unquote, the history that we consider to be standard, you know, who is George Washington, what was he doing, I took the bigger themes and made them into footnotes. So I tried to kind of reverse the whole idea of the book. So what's a footnote is really what is most highlighted, and what it would normally consider to be a big theme, those big themes, I kind of explore them in the footnotes. So it's an upside-down book is what I'm trying to say.
Do you think we do enough, and I guess when I say we, I mean us as a nation and specifically the National Park Service, in telling this story and telling this role, and what can we do to expand it?
Well, I mean, I've met the most brilliant National Park Service people all around the country. I'm lucky to have, my wife's from Oregon. We've driven all across the country, all around the country. I mean, the national parks, I don't think we do enough. I guess nobody ever asked me a question like this. This is sort of what would you do? I don't think we do enough to excite our young people about what has happened and how that relates to where we are right now, how it relates to their life. Because we're in the past always. We're stepping in it, and we're dealing with its reverberations all the time. And if we think we can ignore it, we can't. It matters to us, the past, even as we walk these old trails or these very signal points that I'm talking about that Washington used to signal the troops. If you go to them, you can see that to a point, I tried to reenact a signal, and I discovered in so doing, I signaled 18 miles back to my daughter in Brooklyn from New Jersey, from a hilltop. And yeah. I discovered that these very same points that were once Washington signal points, and surely signal points for, you know, indigenous people, for Native Americans in the area, but they became Washington's points. Then they became Soviet or anti-Soviet bomber missile sites that the Army put in the 1950s and 60s, manned until the 60s. And then they became, almost to a note, they became memorials for 9/11, because communities went to those same points to look back at the city and the giant kind of amphitheater of New York, of the estuary of New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. So these points are almost folkways that we return to, physically matter to us. So I just feel, I've always felt that we should take 6th and 7th grade all around the country and just get the kids outside and map. Just go out with maps and map your town, map the area, map the community. And now you could do it with digital cameras and balloons. Map everything. Look at the old streams. Look at who lived where. Talk to older people. That's what we should be doing. But of course, as you may have noticed, no one's listening to me.
Well, they should, and they can, now that you have it in one complete volume. It's My American Revolution, Crossing the Delaware, and I-78. It's published by FSG. Bob Sullivan is the author. Bob, this is endlessly enjoyable. I thank you very much for sharing with us this morning. A great pleasure.
You're very nice to call me, so thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, My American Revolution, Crossing the Delaware and I-78, published by FSG. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.